Good morning. I'm Charlie Meyerson, and our guest this morning on Point of View is one of the most renowned science fiction authors of our time, Greg Bear, the winner of the Hugo Award, which is bestowed by science fiction fans, and the Nebula Award, which is bestowed by science fiction writers themselves. A former member, I guess present member, although an inactive member, you can explain that in a little bit, of the National Space Policy Citizens Advisory Council, and nowadays a space and technology commentator for Seattle's NPR station. Greg Bear is passing through Chicago to promote two new books, Moving Mars, just issued in paperback, and the hardbound Songs of Earth and Power. Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What's the deal with the National Space Policy Citizens Advisory Council? Your public relations agent mentions it in the material the publisher is sending out.
Well, about 10 years ago, Jerry Pournelle, who's a very well-known and best-selling science fiction writer, put together a group of rocket scientists, of generals and engineers and writers, to present space policy advisory documents to Ronald Reagan, and that continued for a number of years on a number of issues, including space program material, but also on the Star Wars defense program.
Of course, Star Wars is all but dead at this point, and
Did its job, didn't it?
Yeah, I guess some people.
Whether we could have done it or not is really a moot point at this at this time, because I think it was the psychological straw that broke communism, and I don't know if history is going to prove that, but that's what a lot of Russians have told us.
We've got a Democrat in the White House and Republicans about to take over Congress. Is there a place for the National Space Policy Citizens Advisory Committee?
There might be. I think Jerry might be starting it up again, but I haven't heard from him lately about that issue.
You've written more than a dozen novels, by one count anyway, over the last 15 years or so.
Yes.
Is it getting harder to write science fiction, to stay ahead of the trends in science and technology? Things are moving so fast. I mean, just at the consumer electronics level.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's never been easy. Never been easy to write science fiction. I always have found that if I am writing a contemporary novel, Forge of God, for example, begins in contemporary times, that the work goes so much easier than if I'm writing something like Moving Mars, which I have to describe things 180 years from now and make up a lot more stuff.
Is science fiction enjoying a rebirth, or Is it suffering as a consequence of how quickly things are changing in the real world, or what we might call the real world?
A little of both. It's suffering from a kind of psychological turning inwardness that America has been going through, where the end of the Cold War and the end of any major threat seems to have made us want to cozy in and cocoon in. However, it does seem to have an intense interest in the media, where science fiction films have always dominated the top 10 list. And I find that there seems to be a growing interest, a renewed interest, let's say, in the convincing kind of hard science fiction that I write, which I find very encouraging.
Does it get frustrating as a science fiction author to see your books, in a sense, ghettoized? I mean, the science fiction books, almost always, regardless of how well they sell, are often in the big chain bookstores anyway, kept off to one side in the science fiction section.
Oh, sure, they're pulled off into the science fiction section until they hit the New York Times list, yeah. And then they become that massive genre of bestseller, which transcends all boundaries. I think our ghetto actually reaches around virtually all other forms of literature. If you look at what science fiction imagery has done to the entire American culture, the society has embraced science fiction to its very heart. Whether or not they actually want to carry that into practical effect and go into space, renew the space program, that sort of thing, that remains to be seen. But in terms of popular appeal, science fiction is simply enormous.
You wrote recently in Locus, which is a newspaper that deals exclusively with science fiction, literature, and media, nostalgically, as many people have, about the Apollo mission to the moon back in 1969 and the following missions, and how society has
dropped the ball and turned away
yeah. From what so many science fiction writers were predicting would be the case in at the end of this century and the beginning of the next century.
Well, it's not so much that I feel the science fiction writers are disappointed as I feel we did drop the ball. And as a child of the 60s and 70s, I feel dismayed at the thought that we don't feel we can go back to the moon easily now. We did it. We could do it in another 2 or 3 years if we wanted to. All the people who want to do it would crank up and work their hearts out to do it. All it takes is a vote of the American people to get it going.
This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Meyerson, talking to science fiction author Greg Bear, whose two latest books are Moving Mars and Songs of Earth and Power, the information highway that so many people who traffic in news of the real world, there's that phrase again, have become so excited about this year in particular, pops up almost as an afterthought in your books and those of many of your contemporary authors. What do you think? What's your take on the information superhighway and this exchange of ideas that's taking place through the ether?
Fabulous amounts of money are being spent on trying to figure out what this all means. I think I have a pretty clear picture of what it means, and I think it belongs in the background pretty much until we figure out how to fill 500 channels with coherent information. We can hardly fill 20 now with interesting material. We need more good writers. We need more people who understand story. As far as the internet goes and its growth potential, it's going to be a huge intellectual telephone line with graphics and library materials all available at a few minutes' notice. That, I think, will be revolutionary. As far as the interactive media, multimedia, CD-ROM work, we have a lot of people from the entertainment industries thinking it's going to be a lot of the same old, where they can simply market movies in new ways. And I don't think it's going to be that way at all. I believe that the people who are loosely called Generation Xers are going to have their say on this. And I think we may not be able to predict what they're going to do with it.
You have been interviewed, and this is one of the things I dug up on the information highway or the information rest stop or wherever, out of the Archives of America Online. You were subject to one of these online press conferences. People ask you questions. Well, what's it like to be there and have these questions coming at you from all over the country?
All over the country is pretty normal in an international press conference. On America Online, you sit down and type your answers, and you receive the questions in print on a screen, your computer screen. And sometimes they come in one, two, three questions backed up at once, and you kind of have to meld them together into an answer or answer them individually, which drags on. There is a fair amount of time on an America Online interview to sit and think. Before you send your message out, you can revise it, unlike radio, where I can't go back and pull it back, especially if it's live. I think America Online, the CompuServe, the Genie interviews are a very interesting way of doing something, but they're also very low technology because they consist entirely of text. In the next few years, with the fiber optics connections, we'll be able to do voices and text and have sidebars pop up and do these very glitzy public relations campaigns, and we'll lose a little bit of innocence and have a lot more sophistication.
Several months ago, we had William Gibson on the show, the man who coined the phrase cyberspace, and he insisted then, I haven't talked to him since, that he is not available, does not have an email address, didn't have an email address. Now, do you, and is it something that you give out publicly?
Yeah, I'm afraid that I'm not quite as anti-hip as Bill is. Bill has got his place in the dictionary, and he's got his place in the public consciousness as the man who invented all this stuff but doesn't like computers. I actually love computers. I love tinkering with them. I love getting on the internet. I am not, however, a hacker by any step of the imagination. What I do is basically pretty simple and pretty straightforward, but I enjoy it a lot. In fact, I'm a big fan of all the new technology. I'm only a curmudgeon when I come down and try and figure out how this relates to the central values of the heart, which it doesn't, because it's just a way of communicating what people think and feel. And if the people don't think and feel, there's no communication.
I want to emphasize, because I've read many of your books, that's something, even though you do write, you know, what fans would call hard science fiction, which is rife with technological information, and people who want to learn or think a little bit about science can do that. There's also great depth to your characterizations. I mean, they are real people who are dealing with this technology.
That's the most important part.
Yeah.
Most important part for me. And when I describe my books, I say this is, for example, on Moving Mars, I say this is the autobiography of a woman. And then I add 180 years from now. the future, the technology, none of it is important if the heart doesn't feel something.
But before I let you off the hook, what's your email address? Do you want to let our listeners know?
Email address on internet is grbear@ix.netcom.com.
And that's B-E-A-R.
B-E-A-R. Okay. No spaces between any of the words.
Watch for junk mail from our WNUA listeners out there. This is WNUA 95.5. You're listening to Point of View. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Our guest is science fiction author Greg Bear. Tell our listeners a little about your two latest books. Now, Moving Mars was out in hardcover last year, and now is out in paperback, and the other one is, where are my notes here? I got Songs of Earth and Power. Give our listeners some thumbnail sketches of those books.
Well, Moving Mars was published by Tor, and as I described earlier, is actually an autobiography. It's my first novel to deal with the first-person character writing about herself. And to get entirely into the female mode, I've been preparing for this for a number of years because I've had a lot of strong female characters as point-of-view characters. And I didn't find it that difficult this time around. The questions as to whether or not male writers can write about females convincingly will just have to wait until people read the book. So far, I've had good response from a lot of women who find this, I think, to be actually a woman's novel, and to find it to be very interesting that way. Songs of Earth and Power is really the culmination of almost 23 years of work. It's got bits and pieces of the first novel I wrote when I was 19 years old, which I rewrote and had published as a paperback in 1984, and added a second part to in 1986, and those have been in print and paperback for a number of years all around the world. But what I wanted to do when Tor decided to publish both of them together in one volume was revise them, clean them up. I'm very fond of this. It's my only fantasy novel. And now they're together. I haven't found a single typo or spelling error in the entire book so far, which is quite surprising.
Don't you hate that?
I hate it when it happens. In fact, in the paperback of Moving Mars, there's an awful one. We in the hardcover, we got it all right, but the oldest joke of all is that the typographers will turn causal, as in physics, into casual. And that happened in several places, which I only discover when I'm reading before an audience and I start cracking up. It's quite embarrassing.
Okay, for our listeners who have their copies handy, what page is it on?
I'm not sure. It's probably all the way through the book. We'll have to spell check it yourself because causal is in the dictionary. It's just not in the computer dictionaries.
I've enjoyed a number of your books I guess you could call it a high-tech form, audio cassettes. And I have to add, in case my bosses are listening, that I listen to books on tape largely when I'm on vacation, and I just can't pick up WNBA.
And while you're commuting, right?
While I'm commuting, I listen to WNBA. What do you as an author think about this? You know, it's a relatively new avenue for publication and distribution of your material. Do authors have a hard time sharing their creative vision with, you know, these professional actors or readers who deliver the book?
I've been very lucky. I thought one of the hardest books to do that with would have been my novel, Queen of Angels.
Excellent.
And they did a very good job, and Books on Tape did a great job of it. And it has a lot of graphic text embellishments and so on, which they managed to convey fairly well. I think it might be difficult to read on a noisy expressway. To listen to.
It works.
Yeah.
But noisy expressway out of the Chicago area, out of the WNBA.
out of the radius of the radio.
It does work. That's right.
No, I've been very happy with what they've done.
Yeah. As a man who makes his living envisioning the future, which of your books do you consider closest to what you really expect the future will be like?
Very likely Queen of Angels. I wanted to convey the notion of extraordinary change at the same time of dealing with typical human problems that are familiar to us today. Politics, psychosis in the case of the main character in Queen of Angels. I wanted to talk about a society where perhaps we would be on the edge of really being able to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, to get our mental act together, to have medicine actually be able to fix us psychologically, and then deal with the implications of that. Do we in fact love our little idiosyncrasies so much that they are what makes us human? If so, the future is going to be very challenging. We will know how the brain works, and we will know how to fix people who don't, in our opinions, work correctly. There will then be societies and economic systems that demand that you be mentally healthy to work, to function in society. And there will be two classes, the therapied and the untherapied.
I think this is the real value of science fiction, is the opportunity for discourse and thought among readers and authors on issues that we're all going to have to confront before we have to confront them.
It's a great ferment. I just finished editing an anthology called New Legends, and as I was editing this anthology of original convincing science fiction stories, I realized that science fiction is all about people talking to each other within the field, outside the field, scientists meeting and talking with science fiction writers. To my enormous interest, I discovered in an article that's published in there that the people at Los Alamos were all avid science fiction readers in 1943, that they had copies of Astounding Magazine lying around. In that sense, I think science fiction has known sin as much as science. But this notion of talking and communicating cross-culturally, science fiction becomes, I think, the subconscious mind of science, and then of Western culture in general.
What do you consider the most pressing scientific or technological problem of our day? And what is or what can science fiction do about it? Maybe you've answered that one.
The most pressing problem is education. Especially in America, we've never had a lot of respect for education. We've always known that it was necessary, but our rugged individualism has given us a conflicting point of view about people teaching our children. But we need to focus on giving our children the information necessary to become good voters. And we've seen a lot of problems with this in the last 10 or 15 years, where information becomes reduced to sound bites and dim views of what are really very complex subjects. And when people vote on those, you have knee-jerk voting, and it becomes very, very dangerous.
Our guest on Point of View, science fiction author Greg Bear, you've recently, and maybe among other times, ventured away from literature and served as, let's see, what's the title, technical and speculations advisor to a TV show, to NBC's Earth 2. What's that like?
Well, that was very enjoyable. I was working with Carol Flint and the other creators on the show, and they were both story editors and writers and producers. But they, while they'd had a lot of experience writing television shows such as L.A. Law and China Beach, they had never really done a big, heavy-duty science fiction show. And they needed to be brought up to speed. They needed to be told what the tropes were, what the themes could be, how to handle this type of material, how to get their science right. And on the pilot show, the pilot episode of 2 hours, I advised on the screenplay. And I think I saved them from a few problems. What they had in strengths were the characterizations and their writing abilities, their ability to turn out a good script. What I gave them, I think, was a way to avoid tripping up on the pitfalls that science fiction so often provides for beginning writers.
Well, a couple of questions. How did you get that job?
Well, they called me, a friend who was a very well-known television writer, received a call from Carol Flint, and he recommended that they talk to me. And they did, and they found out that that I was useful. I've always been a motion picture and television fan. I love special effects. I can almost break down the budget costs for a special effects project, and it was just a lot of fun.
And then tell us about some of the things, some of the mistakes you saved them from, and I guess by extension, some of the mistakes that have been common.
Well, they weren't so much mistakes as perhaps problems in conception. A lot of media science fiction deals with simplified versions of the universe. The early form of the idea was that these ships would have almost instantaneous travel to these star systems 22 light years away. I edged them away from that. I said it's going to take at least 22 years to get there, and probably a lot longer. Instead of having these enormous spaceships that that fill the entire screen and, you know, are millions of acres in size, you should probably have a very tight, small ship with hibernacula, these sleeping chambers in them, where they will have a cold sleep and wake up in time. That sort of stuff. They picked up on this very quickly, and I think they did a credible job in the pilot show.
But now you don't have a continuing role with the show.
No. They figured out that I was behaving too much, I think, like an executive producer, and they already had four of those and Steven Spielberg to deal with. And so we parted company.
Well, I mean, so have the shows since then maintained a consistent vision?
Or they seem to be doing very well in the ratings.
Well, have they been following?
I haven't seen more than the first two episodes, so I can't really judge. I think those were okay.
What about other science fiction on television in general?
Well, I've been a Trekkie since 1966. I think that Star Trek has become part of the pop culture and has really helped to explain basic science fiction concepts to the general public. The downside on that is that people think that Star Trek or Star Wars are the be-all and end-all of science fiction. And I still think the most sophisticated forms of science fiction are in print. For one thing, our budgets are unlimited when you're sitting at the computer. You don't have to worry about computer graphics or anything. We can do as many aliens as we want and describe them in any way we want. Science fiction is both disturbing and, I think, wonderfully appealing, especially to people who understand that change is constant. If you're a fan of things changing, science fiction is your literature.
What are you working on next? What other projects do you have in the works, literary and otherwise?
Well, right now I'm actually writing a book for my kids. It's going to be a young adult to adult novel about dinosaurs, and I'm having a wonderful time writing it. I've just finished a novel called Legacy, which will be published in June by Tor, and that is it's set in the same universe as Eon, but about 500 years before Eon. I consider it a cross between Lawrence of Arabia and Heart of Darkness. I just finished that and immediately launched into my dinosaur novel. I've always been a fan of dinosaurs, and now I'm going to take my crack at it and see if I can write a cracking good adventure story without any of the elements of Jurassic Park. No time travel, just dinosaurs.
Any babies eaten there?
Nope, no babies eaten.
Okay. Our guest on Point of View on WNUA 95.5, author, futurist, science commentator Greg Bear. Latest books are Moving Mars, $5.99 in paperback, and Songs of Earth and Power, $22.95 hardcover from Tor Books. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thanks for listening.
This is from Moving Mars, and this is a young Martian woman's first experience of the planet Earth 180 years from now. Even now, at a distance of 60 years and 10,000 light years, my heart beats faster and my eyes flow with tears at the memory of my first day on Earth. I remember in a series of vivid still frames the confusion of the customs area on Piece 3, passengers from two crossings floating in queues outlined by tiny red lights, Oriana and I bidding our quick farewells, exchanging personal reference numbers, mine newly assigned for Earth and hers upgraded to an adult status unrestricted, promising to call us soon, as we were settled, however long that might take, transferring Alice 2 by hand from the niche on Tuamotu, promising the customs officer she contained nowhere in violation of the World Net Act of 2079, politely refusing, under diplomatic privilege, the thinker control authorities offer to sweep her for such instances we might not be aware of, obtaining our diplomatic clearances under United States sponsorship, crossing the Earthgate corridor filled with artwork created by the homeworld's children, entering the hatch of the transfer shuttle, taking our seats with 60 other passengers, staring for 10 minutes at the close-up direct view of Earth, pushing free of the platform, descending, feeling the window beside my seat become hot to the touch, the thick ocean of air buffeting us with enough violence to make me grab my seat arms, Red Rabbit coming home, heart pounding, armpits damp with expectation and a peculiar anxiety. Will I be worthy? Can Earth love me, someone not born in her house? The sunset, glorious, red and orange, an arc like a necklace wrapped around the beautiful blue and white shoulders of Earth, seen through flashes of fierce red ionization as we bounced and slowed and made our descent into a broad artificial lake near Arlington in the old state of Virginia. Steam billowed thick and white as we rolled gently on our backs, just as the first astronauts had rolled, waiting for their rescue. Arbiter tugs as big as Tuamotu floated on the rippling blue water. Water! So much water! The tugs grabbed our transfer shuttle in gentle pincers and pushed us toward shore terminals. Other shuttles came in beside us, some from the moon, some from other orbital platforms, casting great clouds of spray and steam with their torch-gentled impacts in the huge basin. Alan held my hand, and I clutched his, made dear siblings by wonder and no small fear. Across the aisle from us, seated beside a padded and restrained Alice, Bithra stared grimly ahead, lost in thought. Now our work really began. We were not just Martians, not mere red rabbits on an improbable play trip. We were symbols of Mars. We would be famous for a time, wrapped in the enthusiasm of Earth's citizens for Martian visitors. We would be hardy settlers returning to civilization, bringing a message for the United States Congress. We would smile and keep our mouths closed in the face of 10,000 litvid questions. We would make gracious responses to ridiculous inquiries. What is it like to come home? Ridiculous, but not so very ridiculous. Mars was truly my home, and I missed him already in this wonderful strangeness, but I knew Earth, too.